Hey guys, we're back for another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. We threw you a bone last week because we had a prior commitment. Somebody did. I forget who it was exactly. Was it me? It doesn't matter. Anyway, we threw you an old bone last week, but we've got a new bone this week. Kelly, are you in the big chair? Is that right?
I am, and I don't know if I like that.
I don't think I do either now that I've said it that way.
Because I'm in the big chair.
All right, let's start over.
I don't like that at all.
My name is Scott Wright. I am a mediocre journalist.
Kelly Turner, not a doctor.
Katie Givens, not a lawyer.
Okay, guys, so as you sit at home and listen this morning or this afternoon or whenever it is, it's September the 18th if you're listening on Wednesday, the day the podcast drops.
Yes.
Fall is coming soon.
Ooh.
Do you already have all your Halloween decorations up?
Not yet. Kelly? October 1.
Okay. I didn't know exactly. I thought maybe you had already gone through your Halloween celebration and had Christmas up already because I know you get started early.
I don't get started early with Christmas, I do with Halloween.
Okay.
But October 1.
So. We'll have an update on that soon.
Yeah.
I'm assuming. And then we're going to do some fun stuff in October here on the podcast, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, fun question mark?
Well, yeah.
How big of a sicko are you?
Some interesting things.
Yeah, some appropriate.
Yeah, I don't want to give anything away, but we will be visiting London in the 1880s.
Yeah, and there will be some blood suckers that we talk about.
Ooh, okay.
So yeah, there's a little, that's the most of a hint you'll ever get from me.
Yeah. Then that's more than you wanted me to give. I know. So sorry about that.
I like it.
Okay, cool. Shout outs. We're behind on our shout outs, but Stacey Higgins and Casey Pearson.
Hello.
Are both friends of the show. I found out recently. I saw them at a place that wasn't Easy Street that I'm not allowed to mention on this show. And we know that means it was not Jake's on the Lake because we mention that place all the time. But it's closed now.
It's closed. Just don't try.
Until next Memorial Day.
Yeah.
Unless Jake gets lazy and never opens the place again. We'll all find out together. Right?
Yeah.
Anyway, so Stacey and Casey, we appreciate you listening to the show. There's your shout out.
Hey, thank you all so much.
That's all I got.
Okay. All right. I felt like there was going to be more, but
There is one other thing.
Oh, okay.
If you're listening this week, if it's not September the 20th yet, this Friday at Easy Street, it will be the final Star Search Karaoke semifinal round. Yours truly will be hosting.
Yeah.
I think we have 10 or 11 contestants. And sometime later in the year, October, I think Shane has circled on the calendar.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's finalized or not.
Yeah, I don't think it is. But anyway, at some point later this year, we will have the big finale. Somebody's going to walk out of there with $1,000.
Yeah.
And they'll get their picture on one of the big sound panels until next year.
It's really entertaining just to go and sit in the audience.
Yeah, because it's quality entertainment.
It's fun.
Everybody who gets this far, almost everybody, can sing really well. We got a couple of stragglers that we're like, yeah, go ahead.
But you know what? That's fun, too.
That's fun, too.
But karaoke's fun, no matter what. And am I correct, Scott? Would this be an opportunity to meet the one and only Shorty that we've talked about? That has been on another podcast sponsored by Easy Street.
Corner Bar Live at Easy Street, and he is the new big celebrity on that podcast because he's got some great stories. I talked to him this week. He's already picking out from his long list of stories what he's going to tell us the next time.
He is such a great storyteller.
Yeah, he is.
Mm-hmm. Listen, I tuned into that episode and I stopped and texted Shorty and I said, I'm already laughing out loud, and you have only introduced yourself.
Yeah, that's all it takes. Yeah, he'll be one of the judges. He will be a judge. Stacy will be a judge, and I'm not sure who Stephanie will
Stephanie,
be a judge.
His wife. Lovely wife who's been on our show when we did the Columbine episode.
That's right. So I'm not sure who the other two judges are, but they set it up just like Star Search. We have the tables down front, and they give a little feedback after each contestant.
Is Jenny Hatmaker a judge?
She has been a couple of times. She wasn't last time. She had a previous engagement. Okay. I think it was on her anniversary.
Oh, okay.
I think
she
and Skip skipped town and did something fun on their anniversary.
So Jenny has been on our podcast as well when we talked about JonBenet Ramsey. Mm-hmm. So all of these people who are local celebrities, you can meet Friday night at Easy Street.
I've got one last thing.
All right.
So recently I was on the Beyond 21 podcast.
Okay.
Caitlin Jolly Gossett and Callie asked me to come on and talk about my memories from 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was a fun time. We had a great time doing that. And they wanted me to extend an invitation to the both of you.
All right.
They want each of you to come on at some point in the future. They like to have guests every week.
Sure.
We like to cloister ourselves inside the Easy Street studio and lock the door behind us and not let anybody in most of the time.
Right. Yeah.
But they like to have guests.
Okay.
So they want each of you to come whenever you would like. They said just reach out and they will make it happen.
Oh, that sounds great.
I'm tired of talking. I'm going to sit back and listen in the dummy chair.
Now, are either of them old enough to remember 9/11?
Barely, Caitlin said that she has been told a story that she has vague memories of. She was 2 years old sitting in front of the TV when the second plane hit. And then she said, school, Daddy, another plane.
Yeah. And in school, they have shown videos and because I know my kids see it every year because my kids are like, oh,
yeah,
you know, because it's really sad. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's something that needs to be remembered.
Yeah.
I know, and it was like this year for the first time it had clicked to me. People were talking about the reason we need to keep talking about it is because most of the kids in school now were not alive. And I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, don't remember it.
Time flies. Yeah, Callie was in the womb, she said, Caitlin was almost two, I think. So
I was in grad school.
I was the managing editor of the newspaper. So it's
you were already a mediocre journalist.
I was well on my way to being half-assed at my job, which I have come full circle and full-assed.
There you go.
By now.
Good deal.
Seems like I used that joke last week. Anyway, moving along.
That's what it is.
Yep. Okay, so are you ready today?
You tell me.
All right.
Based on the photograph you showed me a minute ago, absolutely not.
Yeah.
It's kind of a creepy photo of this lady that we're going to talk about today. And we haven't had something like this in quite a while. I know in season one, we talked about several murderous females.
We did. Several from Alabama.
Who liked to use poison and various things. And we're going to touch on that a little bit today, but there's even more to it. This is not a lady from Alabama, and as far as I know, I could not find an Alabama tie.
Okay.
However, there might be, because there are so many victims, somebody might have an Alabama tie.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going to be a high body count today.
Ooh.
Wow.
I'm just kind of preparing you. And I wasn't prepared. This was suggested to me by a colleague of mine, Dr. Kathy Simpson, and I'm terrified. I said, Kathy, if you send me anything else, I'm very afraid.
is she a fan of the show?
She is. And okay. she said, that's a good one. And I said, I don't know if good is the way to say it, but she said, but you know what I mean. Because she's a true crime nut like we are.
Okay.
And I'm comfortable saying that. I would say that to her. I'm not talking about
that. What part of the time in the past?
We're
going to
go
late,
and don't lose me here when I say this. The late 1800s, early 1900s.
Okay.
It's still
no.
You get that far back in history, and people go, well, I don't know. Stay with me today. So, all right, I'm going to take a sip of my beverage.
That's a beer. Seems a little early, but whatever.
Yum.
Who am I to judge?
All right. You're going to need it for this. Okay. Here we go. This is the story of Jolly Jane Toppin. Toppin. I just already got her name wrong. Jane Toppin.
Right.
She wasn't born Jane Toppin. She was actually born Honora Kelly on March the 31st, 1854. She's the youngest of three children. Her parents were Bridget Finn and Peter Kelly.
You've already used more names in 30 seconds than I use in an entire
episode. I'm going to keep going with it. I didn't spare a name. Her father was an alcoholic with violent outbursts. He was a very odd man as well, and so much so that people kind of went the other way when they saw Peter Kelly coming to them. He was referred to as Kelly the Crack, as in crackpot.
Okay.
Crazy man.
Kind of like Charles Guiteau.
Kind of.
Get out.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Kelly the Crack. So on September the 25th, 1859, his wife Bridget dies from tuberculosis. So he is left to care for their three children, and he is a ridiculously unfit father. He has no business. He had no business having three children, much less caring for three children. In February of 1863, he finally decided that he couldn't do this anymore. So he took his two youngest children, 8-year-old Delilah and 6-year-old Honora, to the Boston Female Asylum and left them there. No record of what happened to the other. There was another daughter who was older. No idea what happened.
Maybe she was married off or something.
Or I couldn't really find it in my research. I'm sure someone who did more than the 101 probably found that out, but I didn't, you know, we're the 101. And there's so much to cover here. So the place was, you know, later renamed the Boston Society for the Care of Girls. It was an orphanage for girls. But when they were dropped off, it was the Boston Female Asylum. immediately looking at the girls, they voted to take them in. It was very, very obvious the abuse and the neglect that was happening to the 6 and 8 year old, these little girls. They never saw their father again. He left them and he was out.
Sounds like a good idea.
Done. It was probably the best thing that he could have done, mm-hmm. but it didn't work out well for the two girls, obviously. In November of 1863, not long after they had been there, a lady named Anne Toppin showed up to the asylum and wanted to adopt Honora. Just her. She was from Lowell, Massachusetts. L-O-W-E-L-L. Lowell.
Sounds right.
I guess they probably say it with less southern accent. This was approved, however, but there were no adoption papers. What they later found out is the paperwork that they gave to Anne for Honora was for an apprenticeship, like indenture papers. They essentially sold her as an employee at 8 years old. At 6 years, no. Yeah, she's six.
Six.
6 years old.
Sadly, not uncommon at the time.
To this lady.
Mind blown.
I know. Anne immediately changes Honora Kelly's name to Jane Toppin. From now on, she's Jane Toppin.
All right.
I'm going to talk about a book, and I'll reference it in our notes, by Harold Schechter. And it's a really good, thorough book about this story. But according to his book, the sister Delilah lived out a very sad and short life. Addiction, sex work, and eventually died in the streets.
Oh, bless her.
Now, Jane is living with Anne Toppin and her daughter, Elizabeth. And as you might can guess, Jane was treated differently than Elizabeth. She was the help.
So she did go to this orphanage to find some housework.
She did. She went to find a servant, basically. Anne is also very prejudiced to the Irish. And
not uncommon.
And, you know, Jane's former name, Honora Kelly, she's Irish.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And she constantly belittles Jane for being Irish. But Jane seems to take everything in stride and has this strange, cheery disposition on life.
Hmm.
So far, this sounds like the inspiration for Cinderella, but I think it's going to take a dark turn.
It is. Okay. It is. She's kind of like Cinderella, yeah. Except with Elizabeth, Elizabeth likes Jane and does not treat her badly at all. In fact, Elizabeth loves Jane. Jane resents Elizabeth to her core. And so that is not a good situation. So you kind of have a little bit of a reverse where Cinderella's sisters hated her. And she just was kind of like, what the heck, you know? So Jane has this cheery disposition. She goes into school and the teachers learn that she is highly intelligent and can spin some amazing stories. She is a great liar and a manipulator. And it doesn't take a psychology degree to see that her disposition is a coping mechanism to cover up her self-hatred instilled by her father and her new mother, quote, mother, which she doesn't call mother, she calls her auntie. Now, Jane would spin these elaborate stories. She would tell them about her father being a sailor who lived in China, and she had a brother who fought with the Confederates at Gettysburg and was awarded a medal by President Lincoln. And she also told a story of her sister who charmed an English lord. Fantastic liar.
This is a great
lived
story.
In her little fantasy world, not really hurting anybody with these stories. You know, everybody kind of figured Jane's a liar. But she was so nice and at the time and cheery that people sort of just let it go.
Did the president give Confederate soldiers medals?
I don't think so.
That doesn't sound right to me.
I did a side eye when she said that.
Yeah, I really don't think so. I think that was kind of the point of that.
Well, that's how you know she was telling a lie.
Gets her stories a little bit mixed up. Okay. If Jane was caught doing something wrong, she would spin a web of lies and usually get out of it. She'd play the victim really well. When she grew into a teenager, these little stories and lies turned to gossip and vicious gossip. She would spread rumors about other girls in school that she might find, you know, she's jealous. Mm-hmm. She lied about other students to teachers to try to get them into trouble. But she could always get herself out of trouble. She could lie her way out and charm her way out. Now, at home, that didn't work. When Anne caught Jane doing wrong, when she was telling a lie or didn't finish her chores, she got beat with a switch. Here, we call that a hickory in the South, you know.
Yes.
And you picked it out yourself.
And you picked it out yourself.
And you always made the mistake of picking that thin one the first time.
And that's two more. Go back and get me a good one, and then we're going to add two to the end.
And those little ones are literally like a whip. They bend, you know. It's like a piece of leather.
I'm having flashbacks right
now. Exactly. So, but this would not deter Jane from lying and doing what she wanted to do. She developed into a very selfish, very egotistical, vicious teenage girl. I mean, does that sound so out of the ordinary?
I think I see where this is going.
Now, as I said, Elizabeth loved Jane, and Jane hated Elizabeth, very jealous. And these feelings are only going to intensify when Elizabeth begins dating a man named Oramel Brigham.
Boy, oh boy.
Jane wanted a romantic relationship, but because of this, just her attitude in general, this egocentric attitude, very selfish, also self-loathing attitude, she could not establish relationships. Mm. She did not have healthy relationships with other people. And so, but she wanted one, but she was very jealous of Elizabeth. So it was later determined by an actual psychiatrist to say that Jane actually lacked the ability to feel affection for others.
Ooh, we've dealt with somebody with that deficiency before.
Which is why Jane has found herself on our podcast. Mm-hmm. She saw the relationships of others around her as a constant reminder of her shortcomings. And this vicious cycle. The lies and the manipulation are going to continue to increase. Now, in 1872, Jane turns 18 years old. She graduates from high school and receives a $50 stipend from Anne Taupin, which was part of her indenture contract.
Oh.
Graduate from high school.
Work for me till you're 18. You're an adult now. Here's $50 and you're free to go if you want to. But actually, Jane decided to stay and live there, and she's going to actually live there for another 13 years. During this time, Anne Taupin is going to pass away, and she leaves her house to Elizabeth, who is going to keep Jane on because she loves Jane, but she's keeping her on as a domestic worker. So she's treating her more like an employee than a servant and actually paying her and giving her, you know, being fair to her. And a domestic servant is really, or domestic worker, that was one of the few jobs women could have back at this time.
I was going to say, this is more common back then.
Sure. Sure. Elizabeth is now married to Oramel, and they all live in this house together. And Jane is very jealous. Very jealous. In 1885, Jane finally decides to move out, and she's going to get another job. She doesn't want to be a domestic worker anymore. She doesn't want to live with him anymore. The jobs for women during this time, teacher, factory worker, or nurse. And during this time, nursing jobs were given to women who were out of jail on parole, and it was part of their parole condition to serve as a nurse. There was a very low bar to become a nurse at this time.
Is this like because it's like a gross job? Like,
yes.
Like it's like,
yes.
You know,
remember, we talked
hospitals are nasty.
Last time when we did the Garfield assassination, yes. You didn't want to be in a hospital unless you had nowhere else to go because it was filthy. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you're going to get a nurse who's fresh out of jail taking care of you when you're on your deathbed. And that, I'm sure some of them did just fine, did a great job. But some of them were unsavory characters working in these hospitals.
Wild.
Yeah, the requirements have changed quite a bit to be a nurse. To, you know, present day. Jane, of course, is accepted into the nursing program at Cambridge Hospital in 1887. They were actually a teaching hospital, so they had a little bit of a protocol. They would train the nurses for a little bit, and then before they just turn them loose on patients. So It's very well respected, and during her time at Cambridge, Jane earns this nickname, Jolly Jane. This is, she's got that cheery disposition. The work is terrible. It's gross. It's difficult. Jane's very pleasant, happy while she's doing her job. So they call her Jolly Jane. Jane then begins to gossip and spread rumors about her coworkers. She's very two-faced. Her instructors at Cambridge love Jane. She kind of does that Eddie Haskell thing. You know, if you don't know Eddie Haskell, around adults and teachers, and since he was just this angel. But then when you got him just with the other kids, he was awful. Mm-hmm. So she's kind of that way. Of course, I've already said she's very smart. And the instructors notice she takes very, very detailed notes, especially about the medications, when they're talking about all the medications. And they just love that. Oh, look at Jane. She's so smart. She's so inquisitive. She wants to do her job right.
Yeah, but I kind of see a red flag waving.
Yeah, do you? Now, while she's spreading lies about other people, she ends up spreading lies about a few of the trainees and actually gets them dismissed from the program. She finally graduates from lies and slander to stealing. She steals money, jewelry, clothes from staff and patients. If she is ever suspected or questioned, she gets out of it because she's a charmer.
She learned that in high school.
She's a charmer.
Yeah.
Yes. And the patients loved Jane. But she did not like all of her patients. Some of them she did, but a lot of them she did not. She hated old people. She did not really see why they had to treat older people and keep them alive.
Oh, wow.
Didn't seem necessary to her.
They're going to die anyway.
Yeah. Jane was later described as, quote, extremely reckless and frequently gave larger doses of medication than had been prescribed. Now, back in these days, you know, now, whatever the doctor prescribes is what is given most of the time. Hospitals make it very, very difficult for someone to get too much of a medication, or especially when we're talking about things like morphine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's locked up, they scan it, they draw it out, tons of paperwork. You know, if you've had surgery recently, you've seen this process.
You told us that story about the nurse that came in when Kevin was, and she was, you know.
I'm so glad I didn't know.
Scanning barcodes and making sure it was exactly the correct dosage.
And talking about true crime. And and if I had known this story at the time, I probably would have said, I need somebody else. So, yes, that's a, woof, that was rough. She turned out to be a fabulous nurse and took really good care of my husband. So, you know, she was good. She's not, just probably not a good time for that conversation. Now, Jane in later years will admit that she experimented on patients while at Cambridge. She would give too much medication and just watch and see what happens, or she would withhold medication and just watch. That was the thing Jane loved to watch.
Okay.
Her favorite experimental drugs were morphine and atropine. That's a pain medicine that can have really toxic effects. That's the atropine. Everybody knows atropine. Everybody pretty much knows what morphine is. Right. It's a really strong opiate.
Mm-hmm.
Atropine can have these toxic effects. It can cause them to lose muscle coordination and even have hallucinations. Now, she claims to have killed about a dozen people during her residency doing these experiments.
Like, so she's claiming she didn't do this on purpose. She would just like see what was happening.
She's claiming that she experimented and figured out what was happening and then was very calculated in killing about a dozen people.
Okay. If she determines it's time for them to go, she knows how to make that happen.
Yes, and no one is suspecting anything, partly because of the way she chooses her victims, and then no one is expecting a nurse is giving the wrong medication.
Especially not at a teaching hospital like Cambridge.
Correct.
Yeah.
Highly respectable hospital. She would inject them, stand beside them to see what happened, watch closely. Then she would offer them comfort. She would hug them and touch and caress them and whisper in their ears as they died, And she would even fondle some of her patients while they were dying. She received great gratification from watching them die, but her favorite was when they had convulsions. She loved to watch someone convulse and die.
That's it.
She described her feelings as delirious enjoyment, voluptuous delight, and the greatest conceivable pleasure. She even admitted that it gave her a sexual thrill. She wanted to see...
Check another box on the psychopath list of possible symptoms.
She said she wanted to see the inner workings of their soul as they died. That was her favorite part. Now, it's very difficult for anyone to figure out that Jane is responsible for this because all of these deaths look natural or caused by another illness. So when folks die from morphine who've already been sick, it just seems like they took a turn for the worse. Mm. And Jane would even alter patient records. So she was really good at making it look like, oh, well, I just took a turn. Mm. How about that?
Yeah, she can make it look like he had a fever for 3 days.
Yes. I'm so glad, Jane, that you were there in their last hour to be with them. Kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's the part that she played. She's the angel of mercy. Mass General is the next hospital she goes to in 1889 after her training at Cambridge, and she has perfected her experiments and knows exactly what to do. Then she wants to go work at Mass General, which is a huge renowned hospital.
So Cambridge is Harvard. Mm-hmm. And so she's like at these fancy places.
Mass General is Boston, I'm assuming.
Massachusetts General.
Yeah.
She is.
Okay.
And still a world-renowned hospital.
Right.
So she's going to continue that behavior, manipulation, lies, murder. She's loved by the supervisors. She even gets put in as the head nurse when the head nurse has to go on extended leave.
I shudder to ask why the head nurse might have to go on extended leave.
I don't know, but maybe. Her old tricks, too high dose of medication, stealing, falsifying records. Many, many patients died unexpectedly under Jane's care, and no one is suspecting a thing. There is a surviving victim who later testifies at her trial and says this is what happened to her at Mass General under Jane's care. Her name was Amelia Finney, and she was admitted for abdominal cancer, which is extremely painful. Now, remember, at the time, these hospitals did not have electricity. This was, 1889.
Yeah.
So she's in the hospital in the middle of the night, and she can't sleep because of her pain. Her room is very dark, but she becomes aware that there's someone in her room. And the lamp is lit to find Jane sitting at a chair by the table where the lamp is lit.
Creepy.
Yeah. So when she sees that it's a nurse, she asks her to get a doctor because she's in so much pain. And Jane says, sure, drink this glass of water and I'll go get some help for you. So she drinks the glass of water and she begins to feel numb and her throat got uncomfortably dry. Then she feels the covers move as Jane gets into bed with her. She's whispering in her ear. She's caressing her as she's struggling to breathe. She starts kissing her all over the face and then pressing that same glass of water to her lips again. Now, the lady shuts her mouth and tries to turn her head to fight her off. And then all of a sudden, Jane jumps out of the bed as other staff come walking by. And then eventually, the patient passes out and then... Because the other people were walking by, they noticed an issue and they saved her life. Otherwise, she was about to die at the hands of Jolly Jane. She chalked that incident up to hallucinations, thinking she was just so incredibly ill and in pain and had medication that really did not happen to her. And it wasn't until later, after Jane was arrested, that she comes forward with this story and says, maybe I didn't hallucinate that. and ends up telling that at Jane's trial. Now, Jane continues to steal from staff and patients. If she's ever confronted, she's going to victim up, charm herself out of that. But they want to get rid of her. They're sick of her at Mass General by 1890, and they're looking for a reason to get rid of Jane. The staff, they're done with her lies and her manipulation. Things are kind of fishy, but they never actually suspect her of murder. But they know she's stealing and spreading rumors. Mm-hmm. They know that that is happening, but they can't prove it. So finally, when Jane leaves her assigned ward without permission, they get rid of her. They fire her. They're just looking for a reason. So she's gone. And she goes into private nursing for about a year and then regains her employment back at Cambridge. She starts experimenting on staff at this point. She almost poisoned a 19-year-old trainee to death, but a doctor intervened. And Jane was so good that the trainee didn't even suspect her. The doctor was like, what's going on with this trainee? You know, walks in and finds Jane there. And Jane's like, I don't know. She's sick. You know, and she just plays this role of trying to help her. And the whole time she's comforting the trainee. Trainee doesn't even suspect that Jane's the one that tried to kill her.
Wow.
But her life is actually saved. Now, later, there is another doctor there at Cambridge who becomes suspicious of her behavior and reports her to the administration for reckless use of medications, and Cambridge fires her in 1891. Now, at this point, Jane is 37 years old. She's going to return to private nursing. And if we were a movie and we had a moment where we could do like a montage, right. This is the point in our movie where the murder montage is going to begin.
Okay.
And we'll get to that right after a word from our sponsors.
Kelly and Katie, let me tell you guys a quick story. Recently, while I was dining at Easy Street, I met a man from Georgia who told me that he and his wife were visiting the Weiss Lake area, planning to relocate here permanently when he retires soon. I told him the first thing that came to my mind, call Greg Oliver at Go Realty. The number is 256-504-3847. Greg is the owner and the broker at Go Realty. Right here in Cherokee County, if you're thinking of moving here or anywhere in Northeast Alabama or Northwest Georgia, if you're looking for property anywhere in the area, call Greg. He has a full list of waterfront, residential, commercial, farm, and investment property, and he's ready to help you find exactly what you're looking for. He's got 25 years of experience in the real estate market. Go again and look at that complete list that he currently has for offer. That's Greg Oliver, Weisslake.com. So visit the website or call Greg Oliver at...
What's that number again?
Thanks, guys. 256-504-3847.
Hey, guys. I want to tell you about one of our newest sponsors, and that is Cherokee Family Healthcare. Cherokee Family Healthcare is located right here on Main Street in Center Alabama.
Connie Geimer, who is a nurse practitioner there, is an acute emergency and family specialist, along with Piper Pierce, who's a family and psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. They offer many services at Cherokee Family Healthcare, such as...
They have primary care, mental health, urgent care, can get DOT physicals. They handle weight loss, IV hydration. We all need that from time to time. You can get a same-day appointment, and walk-ins are welcome.
Yeah, so give them a call
at 256-266-1021.
Hey, guys, do you know what time it is?
Tell us.
It's time to plan your best vacation ever right here in beautiful Cherokee County, Alabama.
Many outdoor adventures await. You can wet a hook in beautiful Weiss Lake, swing away at Cherokee Pines Golf Club, climb to the best year-round at Cherokee Rock Village, hike the Little River Canyon National Preserve, take a days-long splash at Pirates Bay Water Park, and there's so much more.
The Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce and Tourism has a full list of recommended lodging facilities, RV sites, and campgrounds, and they're all set up to suit your vacation needs, whatever they may be.
So come see us from wherever you are located. And if you already live right here in Cherokee County, then plan your summer staycation with the Chamber by visiting cherokee-chamber.org.
Guys, we want to let you know that don't forget that Easy Street is now open for lunch 5 days a week, Tuesday through Saturday, open at 11.
Great lunch menu.
Mm, let's do lunch.
Brand new. We've shared it on our Facebook page, and I know that Shane has also shared it on the Easy Street Facebook page, so it's easy to find the menu, and it's terrific. Everything on it.
Yes. What's your favorite thing, Scott?
I like the hamburger steak with the mashed potatoes. The mashed potatoes are better than I can make. And I make pretty darn good mashed potatoes.
No, they are.
They're terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Katie, so what's your favorite?
Yeah.
I like, well, you can get a flatbread pizza. Mm-hmm. I also like just the chicken fingers.
Yeah, chicken fingers are great. Best chicken fingers in town. How about mm-hmm. you, Kelly?
I like the rice bowl with the chicken and the
yeah.
vegetables.
It's all
the
good.
Yum yum sauce.
Ooh.
So delicious. You're not going to go wrong. Salad bar's always fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Have lunch at Easy Street. You might see us there one day.
Yeah, you never know. 11 to 2 every day is when the menu prices on the lunch menu are.
That sounds right.
That's right. Something like that. Everything that comes out of that swinging door is delicious at Easy Street, we promise.
Yes. Thank you to Easy Street, our primary sponsor, our main sponsor.
Yeah. Thanks, Shane. Go eat lunch.
Yes. Yes.
Come see us.
Oh, who, me? Hey, we're back. Thank you to all of our sponsors. Kelly, you had just gotten to the creepy part.
Yeah.
Please continue.
We've not even begun. I mean, okay. It's good. We're in a murder montage.
I can hear it coming.
Yeah. So Israel and Lovey Dunham, they are an 80-year-old couple that is going to have the unfortunate luck of getting Jane to provide care for them.
I think you're just making up names now.
Yeah. Israel dies on May the 26th, 1895. Jane is later going to admit that she poisoned him because he was, quote, feeble and fussy. End quote.
She's
80.
I was about to say, she doesn't like old people. We've established that.
Exactly. His death was actually listed as a strangulated hernia by a coroner. And she's going to stay on 2 more years and care for Lovey until she decides to kill her on September 19th, 1897. Jane murders her sister, Elizabeth, on August 29th, 1899.
That's the one she's had circled on the calendar for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And she's got her eye on Oramel.
Ooh.
So Elizabeth, Jane, and Oramel vacation in Cape Cod quite a bit. And they've been doing this since about 1896. So it's 1899 and it's August. And she's invited to go to Cape Cod with them again on a trip. Oramel wants to invite Jane because Elizabeth is experiencing some depression, and he's like, "Well, you love your sister. Why don't we invite her? You two can go down a little early, have a good time. I'll come later, and that'll be good for you."
Coming soon, physical symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that literally a thing that they used to do? Like, if a woman was depressed, they're like, "Let's get her to the sea."
Yes, go to the sea.
Yeah, take her
get a sister with her because these women are hysterical. Women only understand other women. We don't know about all this.
Fresh salt air will cure everything.
And that hysteria will go away. That depression, whatever. So they go down for a few days before Oramel gets there. Now, he's going to receive a telegraph from Jane stating that Elizabeth is very sick. But Elizabeth is going to die before he can get there. Her death is ruled a stroke. Jane is later going to confess that she let her die, quote, with slow, gripping torture, end quote. She goes on to say, quote, "I climbed into bed with her and held her in my arms and watched with delight as she gasped her life out," end quote. She then stole money from Elizabeth's purse. And when Oramel got there, she told him that Elizabeth's dying wish was for me to have her gold watch and chain.
Diabolical.
Jane killed 70-year-old Mary McNear on December 29th, 1899, after she had been treated by Jane for a cough and cold. Jane then stole her nicest jewelry and clothes.
Merry Christmas.
Mm-hmm. In January of 1900, she goes to visit Oramel. And she's got her eye on Oramel. I've said that, right? She's gotten the sister out of the way. This is this obstacle. Now we can be together.
Oh.
That sort of, I didn't know if it was the eye of attachment or the eye of continued.
Mm-hmm. And Oramel has no clue
death dealing.
That she's killed his wife. Uh-huh. No clue. This is his beloved sister-in-law. So she goes there and she wants him all to herself, but is very upset to find that he had hired 45-year-old Florence Calkins to help with the house.
Not for long.
She kills her on January 15th.
Yeah.
January 27th, 1900, 70-year-old William Ingram was under her care, dead. Myra Connors, her friend, someone who actually was a friend to Jane. She poisoned her using strychnine on February the 7th, 1900. The woman convulsed so much she broke her arm in two places.
Oh, wow.
When you are poisoned with strychnine, convulsions will make your body contort into unhuman-like ways, and you can die from the poison or you can die from the exhaustion of the convulsions.
Wow.
Her friend, someone who had been a friend to her, and she stands there and watches as her friend convulses so much she breaks her arm in two places and finally dies.
Psychopaths have no remorse.
No. No ability to feel affection for others. That's what the psychiatrist said, and I think he got it right.
Nailed it.
Summer, 1901. Jane goes back to the cottage in Cape Cod where they used to vacation. And she stays there for a while because she knows the owners of the property. Alden and Mary Davis. Now, they liked Jane. And they really enjoyed having Jane there for a while until they really got tired of Jane not paying her rent. They had a very, very discounted rent for her that she always had an excuse she just couldn't pay. So Jane goes back to Boston to live in her boarding house after vacationing there pretty much rent-free for a while. And Mary is very upset about this. She says, I've got to go to Boston to visit their daughter. Their daughter, Genevieve, lives in Boston. So she's like, I'm going to go visit Genevieve. I'm going to collect our debt while I'm there. I'm going to go by Jane's house and collect the debt. Mm-hmm. Go see Genevieve. I'll be back home. Alden's like, okay. It's summer. There's a huge heat wave going on in Boston. Just, you know, watch out for the heat wave. That's kind of his only advice, I guess. So Mary gets off the train. She goes straight to Jane's house. Jane is having dinner with her landlords at the time. She invites Mary in, and Mary's telling her, I'm here for the money, here for my rent money. And Jane is very apologetic and is going to pay her, I'm going to go get your money. Would you like a glass of water here before I go get, you know? So Mary, she stands there, talks to the landlords, drinks her glass of water. Jane's going to get her rent money until Mary starts feeling dizzy and weak and eventually collapses. Now, the landlord helps take Mary up to the bedroom, and they're going to chalk this up to, well, this heat wave has really gotten to her. So Jane comes in with a syringe and gives Mary some morphine. This will help you.
Too much, I'm guessing.
Until we can get. Now, the next day, Jane sends a telegraph to Alden that Mary's very ill. And so he sends Genevieve, who's close by, to check on her. So Genevieve comes in, and she's talking to Jane about what's going on, what's wrong with Mom. Mary is a diabetic, and Jane knows this. And so Jane tells Genevieve and the doctor that they've brought in that she ate a huge piece of cake with dinner last night. I tried to get her not to eat that, but she did anyway. And the doctor's quick to say, oh, this is a diabetic coma. Mary's done this to herself.
Mm-hmm.
So Genevieve sits there in Jane's house for the next few days. Jane, you know, comes in to care for Mary. She's giving her these doses of morphine.
I hope she doesn't drink the water.
Atropine, and makes it look like a very natural death. And finally, on July 4th, she kills Mary after days and days of this, of bringing this woman to the brink of death and pulling her back.
Well, but she's got eyes on her. She's trying to kill this person right in front of her daughter and mm-hmm. the landlords, there, whoever she's living
and
with.
And she's doing it slowly.
Yeah, she's got to. Maybe
she's very mad too, and she wants to.
Okay.
And so right in front of her own daughter, she slowly tortures this woman to death. Now, Genevieve and her sister Minnie are going to invite Jane to stay with their family in their family home near the Cape Cod area because Dad is left alone now, Alden, until he can take care of himself, Jane, will you please come and stay in our family home and help us?
Wow.
And Jane, of course, agrees.
Well, she's a nurse. She meets all the qualifications.
And she tried to care for mom so much, but why, mom, did you eat the cake? Mm. Right? So, within days of arriving to the family home, she sets the house on fire in the middle of the night.
Well, at least she changed her motive.
She has a problem with this whole family because they tried to collect debt from her. How dare they? Now, in the middle of the night, Alden is going to wake up and smell smoke, and he's going to yell for help, and then Jane's going to, quote, help, acting like she just woke up, so they had to put the fire out. That didn't work, right? Jane is going to repeatedly try to set this house on fire with everyone inside. Multiple times, this house is going to catch on fire.
Oh.
For various reasons.
It's the darndest thing, guys. I don't know. It just keeps spontaneously combusting.
Correct. And it's always going to get stopped by a neighbor or someone in the house is going to wake up or whatever. And so Jane is going to start spreading rumors of this arsonist. Oh, you didn't see there was a man standing out there.
Well, she's got that part right.
So she spreads rumors in this little area that there's an arsonist, scares everybody to death in the area, thinking there's some crazed maniac arsonist on the loose.
There is.
But your homes are okay.
For now.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't make her mad. Okay. So Jane kills Genevieve. She spreads lies that Genevieve was very upset and even suicidal after the death of her mother. She claims Genevieve took her own life after finding a syringe near her bed. Jane sets all of that up, spreads the rumors, kills Genevieve. Jane reports going to her funeral and feeling, quote, as jolly as could be, end quote. August the 8th kills Alden Davis. Death is ruled that his heart gave out after the sadness of losing his wife and daughter. August 12th kills Minnie, the other daughter. Gets her to drink cocoa wine. Do you know what that is? That's like wine with cocaine in it.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, that was a thing back then. Injects her with morphine and atropine, and the doctor comes in, tries to give her more cocoa wine. It's like, here, drink this. Have some wine and cocaine. You'll feel better.
Oh, so it's like supposed to be like a stimulant?
It was supposed to be like, yeah, when they're
okay,
sluggish and you know, the effects of the morphine. Well, here, drink this. So Jane then finally gives Minnie a poison enema. She laces something with a lot of whiskey and gives her an enema, and she slowly dies on their couch during the night. And while this is going on, while Minnie is downstairs on the couch, slowly dying, Jane goes into Minnie's 10-year-old son's room. And she gets him out of bed, and she brings him to her room, and she puts him in bed with her, and she just holds him and cuddles him and comforts him all night long while his mom is sick, while his mom dies on the couch downstairs.
It's extra sick.
Yes. Her death is ruled exhaustion. The same doctor that ruled Alden's death as sadness and has ruled this one as exhaustion. This doctor sucks.
Was this like medical school when, I hate to keep going back to Charles Guiteau, but you didn't have to be a lawyer. You didn't have to go to law school back then to be a lawyer. I wonder how much doctoring you had to actually do.
Type of doctors as we talked about with Garfield.
Yeah. I mean, just idiots.
What the heck? And no one is in this family, nobody is suspecting Jane. She's moved in. Their mom dies under weird circumstances at her home. She moves in. The house catches on fire multiple times. One daughter dies. Two daughters die. Dad dies. Who's left in the house? You've got Minnie's husband is left in the house. And Minnie's children. All right, Jane's done with this family. Finally, there's a few cousins left too, but she didn't care about that.
Okay.
She feels like she's gotten her revenge on this family. And in late August 1901, she's going to go back and turn her focus to Oramel. Let me I'm done here. Let me go back and revisit this. I'm going to see if I can get Oramel to fall in love with
me. I was going to ask if there was a financial angle to any of this. She's
obsessed with him.
Revenge. And she wants to marry
Elizabeth's
former husband.
Yes. Now, when she goes back to visit Oramel, his 70-year-old sister Edna's there. Well, she dies on August 26th.
Whoops.
Yeah. She was just not going to share his attention with anybody, even his own sister. Now, in the meantime, Minnie Gibbs' father-in-law is suspicious.
Thank God somebody finally is.
Captain Paul Gibbs, who is Harry's father. Harry is Minnie's husband.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he wants an autopsy on Minnie. And in the meantime, a friend of Alden's comes forth as being very suspicious, and he sort of teams up with Captain Paul Gibbs, and they want all of these bodies exhumed. What they get is they get Genevieve and Minnie exhumed on August 30th.
Pretty fast. I mean, this is happening. This is starting to happen fast.
In the meantime, the police, they've put Detective John Patterson following Jane.
Okay.
So Captain Paul pulled some strings and, you know, got some stuff going. And they find lethal traces of poison in Minnie's stomach. More so than you would ever be exposed to, you know. And they're going to arrest Jane on October 29th, 1901.
All right.
Now, at trial, she's the victim. Forever the victim.
As she has been all her life.
Using her childhood as a reason. Now, Jane had a crappy childhood.
Sure.
Of course she did.
Possibly a reasonable explanation, but not an excuse.
Right. And when she's interviewed by doctors, Jane just finally decides, I'm going to tell all of the stories of all of my kills, and I'm just going to enjoy telling it. So she tells them all of those things that I've talked about, the quotes from Jane about how she felt, and that's where this comes in. These doctors, of course, are horrified, and they're going to diagnose her as having a degenerative type of insanity and actually irresponsible for the homicides.
What?
But they are going to say that she's a danger to society.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We think she's insane and is not responsible for these murders, but we don't necessarily think Jane should be out and about.
All right.
The jury is going to rule that Jane is not guilty by reason of insanity. They're going to agree with the doctors and say, yes, she's insane, but not guilty. But they are going to sentence her to the Taunton Insane Hospital for life.
Okay.
So they're like, you're insane. We can't even fathom someone doing this with delight and all of the things that you've talked about. You're insane. Now you go to the insane hospital for life. You're never getting out on the streets again because the entire world is in danger with you being out and about.
Yeah.
And apparently you can kill people for the span of 15 years and no one's going to get suspicious. You can just kill and kill and kill a whole family.
Yeah.
Thank you, Captain Paul, at least. So Jane's health is going to decline while she's in that hospital, and her mental state is going to deteriorate severely.
Further.
She's very paranoid, and interesting enough, goes through bouts where she refuses to eat because she's afraid someone has poisoned it.
A little ironic.
Valid.
Ironic justice, I guess, right?
Yeah, yeah. Now, on August the 17th, 1938, Jane dies from natural causes at age 84.
So she lived 37 years in the nut house?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, can I say nut house?
Well, back then you could. Today, okay. No.
Well, we're pretending.
Back then it was...
And what was then called the nut house.
She lived until she was 84 years old, and then she pretty, you know, uneventfully just passed away.
I mean, yeah, that's old then.
Mm-hmm.
Shit, and that's old now.
And that is the story of Jolly Jane.
Holy cow.
Toppin.
Wow.
That was
I'll put all the references, especially this book. The book is called The Poisonous Life of a Female Serial Killer.
Well, now I'm glad you mentioned all the names, because it would, if you had just said another one and another one and another one, we would have gotten tired of hearing another one, because there were plenty other ones.
Yeah, yeah, I think you have to say the names.
Yeah.
She confessed to about 31 murders, but she is suspected for close to 100.
So just standard what you think of these days as a psychopath. I mean, Kemper and all the other psychopaths we've talked about on this show, that's, they couldn't resist.
No. And Jane actually...
telling their stories.
Jane got a sexual gratification from it. It even fondled some of her victims while they were dying. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine?
Well, if I wasn't a podcast co-host, probably not.
I know.
Sadly,
I know.
I've heard this a dozen times by now.
Correct. Correct.
So, yeah.
That's just another level of terrifying when you've got... you're in a terribly vulnerable state in a hospital, and the nurse comes in, and it's game over.
Yeah.
But not quickly. Hmm. All the while, the psychological torture and the physical torture and the fear and the sexual abuse that's happening while you're dying, that is next level.
And well, we're not going to miss her. I'm not.
Not. No one. I don't think anybody did. Unfortunately, no one did. So I've got several other references. I'll get those put in the show notes. And there you have it, Jolly Jane.
Well, now I have to go home and shower the creepiness off of my body. But that was a terrific story, and you told a great job, guys. If you think Kelly did a good job too, then give us a shout out on your podcast platform of choice. Reach out to us on Facebook. That's how you get a shout out on the show as well, if you like. Give us an idea for a future show. We get those all the time. Send us an email to truecrimeoneasystreet@gmail.com. Anything else, guys? Is that it?
That's it.
Good night, everybody.